Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business here on Risky.biz. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's episode is hosted by Vigabyte and brought to you by Tenable Network Security. Tenable's the company behind Nessus, an awesome vulnerability scanner, if ever there was one. And they also make all sorts of enterprise-y security and compliance software, so go check them out at tenablesecurity.com if you haven't already. Now, on this week's show, we're having a look back at an issue we covered a little while ago, Plaid. That's not the oh-so-groovy pattern, but Centrelink's home-baked authentication protocol. Plaid is a contactless smart card authentication protocol designed by Australia's welfare agency, using taxpayer money, and released a couple of months ago to the public. Centrelink hopes to have it recognised as an ISO standard, but not everyone is convinced that's a good idea. We'll be hearing from the University of Auckland's Peter Gutman. He's a bit of a rock star in the smart card and crypto field, and he's had a look at the supporting documentation released by Centrelink, and it's fair to say he's not too impressed, so we'll be hearing from him shortly. Now, it might sound like an Australia-centric story, but it's not really, because this is a fascinating issue for anyone who's involved or is considering being involved in writing their own authentication protocol or a similar sort of project. Anyway, that's all coming up after the news. In this week's sponsor segment, we have a chat to Marcus Ranham, who is Tenable Security's Chief Security Officer, about what I like to call the liability chain. Who is liable when things go wrong and when data leaks? That's coming up later. But first to the news, and this week we're chatting with someone different to usual. I'm visiting Sydney this week and caught up with Securus Global's practice manager, Declan Ingram, last night for a few beers. And what better opportunity to do the news? Declan, thank you for doing security in the pub. And the first story this week is about a controversial little email that was dropped onto Full Disclosure during the week. Can you tell us what that was all about?
Yeah, basically what happened was a group of people sent an email off to the Full Disclosure mailing list saying, hey, look, we've got a bunch of data from T-Mobile. We've tried to sell it to their competition and no one's interested, so looks like it's going up for the highest bidder. And it's caused a bit of a stir for two reasons, one of which is, well, is it real or not? And the other one is just how T-Mobile are dealing with it.
Yeah, so it looks like they claim to have obtained all of the source code that controls their network, which would be a pretty prized little score for some of the nastier elements among our precious little community. T-Mobile originally denied that anything had been disclosed and then said, oh, well, actually, we happen to know which document it came from and there's no risk. So what do you think's actually going on?
Well, I actually don't think that anyone really knows what's going on. I think there's two things that really struck me when I first read this. And the first one is T-Mobile's incredible incident response. I think that there's this fantastic thing with PR guys and companies like this where they've got this, they must have some kind of PR course 101, which is like how to deal with a security incident in an organization.
Which is, let me guess, at no time was customer data compromised.
That's right, that's right. How it starts is first you just deny everything, right? And then as soon as the evidence starts to become insurmountable that something actually did happen,
then you concede a little bit of ground.
Yeah, you say, okay, so all right, we admit something did happen, no customer data, right? But the trick and the icing on the cake is to do this so rapidly that anyone who knows anything about incident response or security would know that it was absolutely not possible to do any form of meaningful investigation during this period of time, verifying the fact that you're pretty much talking out your hat.
Out of your hat. That's very diplomatically stated, mate. But you know, what I find interesting about that whole PR response, yeah, the customer data thing, and at no time is customer data at risk, but I would imagine that having the entire source code for all of your sort of telco kit being exposed would perhaps put customer data at risk at a certain point in the future, maybe?
Well, look, that's what you would think. One of the things that they've come out and basically said is no, nothing happened. Okay, yes, something happened, but nothing major. This is a really big question because the guys that have posted the thing onto Full Disclosure have basically just said that we've got a long list of servers and database tables that belong to T-Mobile. Okay, all right, excellent. Have they verified that in any way? No. Has anything come out? Have they posted any data? No. I mean, it would be very easy for me or you to post an email to Full Disclosure saying, hey, look, I've got the source code to Windows Vista, and I tried to sell it to Steve Jobs, and he said, lol, I've already got BSD source code, so I don't care, and so now I'm selling it to the highest bidder. And really, if you're not going to verify that, whatever.
It's a little twist on the Pixar, it didn't happen.
It totally is.
So, yeah, Sorcerer, it didn't happen.
Basically, yeah, I'm calling shenanigans on this. I'm saying, look, give us something to work with, and we'll see if it's worth anything.
Now, in this next piece, it looks like the government is going to start listening to the right sort of people. Jeff Moss has been asked to... Jeff Moss, a.k.a. Dark Tangent, the organiser of Black Hat and DEF CON and all of that good stuff, has been asked to front some sort of DHS, Department of Homeland Security advisory panel.
Yeah, look, this is a real warm and fuzzy, and I felt really good about the world while I was reading this. Jeff Moss is a guy, he's most famous for organising the DEF CON, the DEF CON conferences and also Black Hat and stuff, but he's also worked for EY and he's done lots of stuff. Interestingly enough, he's got a very kind of hacker, real kind of, I'm using inverted commas here, coalface kind of guy in terms of security and security research. And yet he's also kind of, you know, if you look at his resume and his past work in terms of, you know, he's got quite a corporate background as well. So he really is very well situated, very well suited to this position on the Homeland Security Advisory Council. And to give you an idea about the sort of people that are on this council, you know, it's got the likes of, you know, former CIA director Bill Webster, FBI director Louis Fiche, and also
and Jeff Moss.
And Jeff Moss, exactly. Yeah. You know, but also on this advisory council, you know, it's got governors of whoever and mayors of some place and all these other sorts of people on there. And you know, read through the list and there are a couple of people that you think, yeah, they'd probably know something about security, but most of them you just go, okay, they're going to be talking about requirements, they're not going to be talking about delivery. And I felt really good about this. I'm thinking that, okay, finally we've got an administration in the US which are really doing something about security. And then going through and reading a whole heap of articles about it, I found a nice little thing where sort of, you know, it was just pegged onto one of the end of the articles that said, you know, basically what was involved in it. And basically Moss was told that he might have to attend a couple of quarterly meetings, an occasional teleconference, and other than that, it wouldn't be very much work. And that's kind of when my heart sunk, because if you're talking about an advisory council for the security, you know, the security of a nation like the United States, I'd imagine that's a little more work than that, and it kind of really devalues the whole thing for me.
Well, yeah, we do have to worry about the United States and their security, because you know why? They've got the motherfucking bombs.
They do have the bombs, man. They do have the bombs.
Now, on to this next story, and there's some very interesting stuff going on in the world of automatic teller machines, where a dude has actually found some malware on them that not only skims people, but can be used to jackpot the ATMs.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those things, it's fascinating and terrifying and utterly not surprising. You know, I mean, we look at these ATMs and we think, okay, they're hardware, they're bank, they're secure.
But they're not, they're NT4, running on a private IP network that's connected like 6 million ways to the internet.
Exactly, exactly. Now, these ones particularly Windows XP boxes, I mean, that's a pretty generic operating system. Everyone on the planet knows, my lovely mother knows all the problems that are involved with Windows. So it's not like it's any kind of surprise that there's going to be any problem with them, that they're going to be vulnerable to attack. And of course, I mean, I'm just going by purely hearsay here, but I'm going to say that ATMs are critical infrastructure, and so you're not going to take them down every Tuesday of the month to patch them.
Yeah, well, what I find interesting about this, I mean, the basic thrust of this story is that there is malware that is going around specifically targeting ATMs now, so you don't need to attach a skimming device. You could basically Trojan the things and collect the data as it's entered into the system. Now, this is something that's happened overseas, but, you know, we do have a fairly significant audience in financial services and banking in Australia, but I think it's safe to say to the people listening who work in banking in Australia that this sort of attack is coming here.
Oh, look, I mean, if you just have to look at the vendors, I mean, Diebold, NCR, etc., the little logos are on the ATMs everywhere. They're global companies, you know. We don't have Australian brand ATMs. The banks here, I'm sure, are not using their own proprietary stuff. The fact that they're using Windows XP, it's all international. The crime is all international. The protocols, the vulnerabilities are all international. There's nothing that we can say suddenly here that says that we're just going to be safe from this.
Yeah, okay, good point. Well, look, on to the last story of the day, and it's actually a very sad story, which is the boss of LX Labs in India has been found hung. He hanged himself, by the looks of things, after a vulnerability was disclosed in his hypervisor software, and that vulnerability was subsequently used by some miscreants to delete 100,000 websites in the UK. Those were, of course, websites that were running on that LX Labs technology. And yeah, the guy unfortunately felt it was necessary to hang himself. I mean, what do you think of this? Can we say that perhaps this introduces a whole new element to the disclosure debate?
Oh, look, this is... I read this and I was a bit kind of taken back by it, as I think most people would be. I mean, in the security industry, you know, we talk about doing it for lols, we talk about hacking things for fun and profit. We don't really take anything very seriously. And when we talk about, you know, disclosure to organisations, and we tried to talk to them about a vulnerability that we found, and we couldn't get hold of the right person, and they really weren't taking it seriously, so we disclosed it or whatever else. I mean, this is really serious business. On any risk register, the top of it is human life. And the fact that this guy took it so seriously that he took his own life over this is really quite... you know, it's extraordinary, and it's terrible at the same time.
Well, to be fair to the people who disclosed the vulnerability, it was a case where Mealworm contacted them, and they got an initial response, and then the response was sort of found to be lacking after a while, and they did go public. I mean, the guy did have other problems. He was still recovering emotionally from the suicide of his mother and his sister by hanging about 5 years prior, and was said to be upset about the loss of a recent contract. So I don't know that we can explicitly say that this was a direct contributor to his suicide, but I think we can certainly say that it wouldn't have helped his state of mind.
Yeah.
I mean, having 100,000 websites just deleted using a vulnerability in his software, I mean, it would have been I can't imagine that helped.
Oh, look, I really can't imagine it helped either. And especially when you think about the, you know, the personal pride that a lot of people take in their organisations and their software. I mean, but this is also, you know, virtualisation software, and that it's been a big couple of weeks for virtualisation software as well, with Immunity releasing their Cloudburst software, which is sort of about breaking out of VMware VMs.
But wasn't that just like client VMs, like not actually their proper enterprise product? That was like their GSX product. Well, that was the last Cloudburst that I saw, unless they extended it somehow.
Yeah, no, you're right, but I really do see this as, you know, it's the trickle in the crack. It's the trickle coming out of the crack in the dam wall.
Well, it's a sad note to leave this stuff on, Declan, but thank you very much for doing the news this week from the pub in Sydney.
Thank you, Patrick. It's been a pleasure.
Securus Global's practice manager Declan Ingram there in the flesh in a pub in Sydney, who kindly did the news. Now, it's finally time to announce our prize winners from our sign-ups drive. The winner of the EPC is none other than Mark Focus, who is a project manager with the New South Wales Department of Education and Training. So congratulations to Mark. I've actually got to email him and can ship it off to him. The security team at Westpac won the Tiki Tag RFID emulation kit, but they're still sort of working out who on the team gets the gear. And William Shipway and Charles Whale won the little Microsoft toolkit. So congratulations to all of our prize winners. And big thanks to Kaspersky for buying us the EPC to give away. That is our number one prize, and we really do appreciate that. In other housekeeping matters, there's a hot new job up for grabs in Melbourne. You might have heard week before last, I also promoted this on the show. If you're a penetration tester, or you've got some exploit development experience, or you're a really gun web application auditor, there might be a job for you in Melbourne. Just email me at jobs@risky.biz. So, you know, what have you got to lose? Send through a resume, may as well shop it around. You know, you might find you get a nice pay kick out of making the switch, or it could be a good opportunity for someone looking to come into the industry if they've got the right technical skills. So even if you just want some more information, in full confidence, get in touch with me for a chat at jobs@risky.biz. So that is a Melbourne-based penetration testing job for the right person. Now it's time for this week's feature story. And here in Australia, we have a welfare department called Centrelink. It has around 26,000 employees paying out everything from student allowances, pensions and unemployment benefits. It's also an agency that's been looking to roll out a new authentication system for its staff. It had been proceeding with a rollout of some fairly standard PKI stuff, but it's not entirely happy with it. So its IT staff has spent several years working on its own contactless smart card authentication protocol. Now, that team actually released its draft implementation and plans to get the PLAID authentication protocol, as it's known, recognised as an ISO standard. It's an extraordinarily ambitious project, and there's already been around $560,000 of taxpayers' money spent on this project. Now, at the time the protocol was released, we had a chat to the project lead, Glenn Mitchell, and here's an excerpt of that interview.
It's designed to allow authentication to system resources, whether it be logical or physical, and it has that in common with a lot of already existing solutions out there, such as PKI. The other aspect of PLAID, which is a little bit more unique to this protocol and some of our motivation behind inventing it, was that in the traffic going to and from the smart card, PLAID was designed to ensure that there was no static information that could be intercepted and captured, which therefore allow the card and therefore the person to be identified. So it's more designed for privacy. Well, it's designed for privacy and security.
Since then, our favourite crypto guy, Peter Gutman, has downloaded the PLAID documentation and given it a quick once-over. And to put it mildly, Gutman found the documentation to be lacking.
Yes, there's a famous quote by Bob Morris, a security guy, saying that the behaviour of a program without a specification can never be wrong, merely surprising. And the problem with this protocol is, they say, here is a protocol, and there is no indication of what they're intending to achieve with this. I mean, right at the end, there's a functional specification at the back saying, here is a wish list of things that are kind of cool to have in a protocol. But they don't explain whether they're addressed in the protocol or how they're addressed in the protocol or which bits of the protocol address which bits of the wish list. So looking at this, there are, you know, I've got this sort of two pages here just covered in little notes in the margins saying, what is the purpose of this? What does this achieve? Why are they doing this? Why are they doing this? Because they don't explain why they're doing this or what they're trying to achieve, it's very hard to analyse the effectiveness of the protocol.
Well, I was hoping you'd have searing criticism and stuff like that, but you're sort of sitting there just going, huh?
Yeah, because, again, there's you can't analyse their behaviour if you don't know what the behaviour is supposed to be. I mean, for example, they do things like, in one point, they encrypt some stuff. Is this meant for confidentiality to keep it secret? Is it meant for authentication? Is it meant for integrity protection so you can't modify it? They use an encryption mode called ECB, which encrypts a whole lot of separate blocks of data. So what you can do is you can take two runs of the protocol or two separate devices and cut and paste blocks from one part of the protocol to another, and they won't be detected. Is that intended or is it an accident of the design? I don't know, because they don't say what they're trying to achieve.
Okay, well, look, say you were setting out to design a protocol. What is the right way to do it?
Generally, the way something like this is done is, if you sort of remember back to high school science experiments, you've got your sort of hypothesis and method and conclusion, that sort of thing. So generally, you do it that way. You start off by saying, you know, here is the intent of the protocol. Here is what other people have done. And again, that's another important point with this. You generally never, ever design a protocol from scratch yourself. You build it on existing protocols, established protocols, well-analyzed stuff like that. So you say, here's what other people have done. Here is the intent of this protocol. Here is, you know, all the security features and facilities that the protocol is supposed to provide. Here's the protocol itself, and then finally, here is how each part of the protocol achieves the goals that we've set out at the start, saying, you know, we need to do this and we need to do this. And generally at the end you say, you know, typically there are some things we can't do, and be aware of this and be aware of that, and maybe for something for future work. So that's a standard academic work, but basically it allows anyone else looking at it to see what you've tried to do, what you are doing, and whether you've achieved that goal.
Well, see, the one thing that I find curious about these guys releasing documentation is they've released documentation and they've released a draft implementation, and they've said, everybody go have a look at it, tell us what's wrong with it. And what you're saying is that's kind of a redundant, or that's not a question that's easy to answer with what they've released. I mean, could it be a case that they did actually go through all of those scientific and academic steps that you just discussed, but they just haven't really released the correct bits of paper?
It may be that they haven't released the correct bits of paper, but There's a protocol design technique called design by twiddle. So you start out with something and you tweak it, and someone points out something and you tweak it again and again. And this looks a bit like that. They just kept tweaking bits and pieces until no one could find anything more to criticise. But again, without a specification, you can't tell what the intent of this is.
So did you actually have a look at the draft implementation? Because it is out there. You can actually download Z-code.
I haven't looked at the draft implementation, because if the documentation doesn't really tell you what's going on, then even if the implementation is a correct implementation of the spec, it's hard to tell whether it's doing what you're supposed to be doing. I mean, let's use an analogy. Let's say you've got a recipe, and one of the steps in the recipe is go upstairs and have a shower using olive oil for soap.
And that sounds like fun.
That's a bizarre step. Now, is that because they're playing a joke on you? Is it because maybe getting olive oil on your hands means it'll get into the food that you're making? Is this a part of the recipe or not? And this has steps in here like this. You know, there are these weird things that... Are they part of the protocol? Are they there by accident? Do they serve a purpose? What purpose do they serve?
So there is actually something in there as ridiculous from a crypto point of view as going upstairs to shower with olive oil.
Well, not necessarily that ridiculous. There are weird things. I mean, another cryptographer looked at this, and I interpreted the specification to say that there are shared keys. So all these smart cards and all the readers have shared secret keys, as far as I could tell. Someone else looked at this and came to exactly the opposite conclusion. They said no one would do something as stupid as that. They can't be shared keys. But you can't tell either way, and we argued about it for a while, and you can't tell either way. The specification just isn't clear enough to tell.
So what do you think needs to happen? Do they need to come out and do a bit more to convince you that this isn't a disaster?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a disaster. I honestly can't tell what the purpose of the protocol is. But again, let's say you've got a completely blank slate and you can do it from scratch. There are existing well-established crypto protocols that do exactly the same as this. I mean, there's one, the very first public key mechanism from 1976, Diffie-Hellman Key Exchange, was modified in about, I think it was 1992, by something called Station to Station, which is this authenticated exchange that they're doing. And in 1995, another cryptographer published an extension of that called Scheme, which is, again, it's a general framework for designing a protocol of this kind. And that's used in, for example, it's used in SSH, it's used in IPsec, and in one of the modes that are used by SSL. And that's been heavily analysed and looked at by cryptographers and extended and tweaked and attacked and so on and so forth. So if you wanted to do something like that, I would take that framework and simply plug stuff into that, because we know that works. Whereas this is, I just don't know what to say about this, because I don't know what it's trying to do.
Pretty much what they've told me and what they've told us in interviews is that the reason they've designed this protocol is because there was nothing out there that would give the cards anonymity. You would always, if you could intercept some sort of telemetry between the card and the reader, you would always be able to identify a card. That's that card that just went through.
Right.
I mean, could that explain why they've gone to such lengths to create something so
not necessarily
seemingly complicated?
Because the Scheme protocol I mentioned, or the Scheme framework, does provide complete anonymity. That was one of the design features of the first version of the IPsec protocol, is that you have complete anonymity. And then someone pointed out that you've got IP addresses that you're talking to, so it's not that anonymous anyway. But that's not the fault of the crypto protocol. There are protocols that, if necessary, provide complete anonymity. And they have been designed by cryptographers and heavily analysed. So, yeah, I don't know why. You know, one of the prime directives of crypto is never invent your own crypto protocols, unless you're a crypto expert and you've had 10 years to analyse it and everything. It's just really, really dangerous to do.
All right. So I guess I gather from what you're saying that you certainly, if you were sitting on some sort of standards council, these guys want to get this standard, you know, ISO certified. If you were sitting on that council, you would want to see a lot more information before you gave it a tick.
I would want to see, basically independent review, refereeing, and you know, it's just much easier if you base it on established, analysed, heavily security field-tested protocols rather than trying to invent your own protocol.
All right. Well, Peter Goodman, as always, mate, it was a pleasure, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Peter Goodman there with a look at Plaid, Centrelink's new authentication protocol. Centrelink was offered a chance to respond to Peter's comments, but chose not to. They did, however, say that better documentation would be forthcoming as the project moved towards its attempted ISO certification. Next up, it's time for this week's sponsor interview with none other than Marcus Renham, Tenable Network Security's Chief Security Officer. I got Marcus on the line, and we started off by talking about the data disclosure laws, which essentially allow companies to get off scot-free once they've sent out a letter fessing up to any sort of data loss incident. It led to an interesting discussion around what I call the liability chain when it comes to fraud.
Here's what bothers me as a taxpayer, is that our elected leaders basically went and decided that they were going to set the system up so that the banks can indemnify each other. simply, or indemnify themselves from the customers simply by sending out a letter. And, you know, I can't think of that many other situations in the real world where somebody can screw up, harm a customer financially, and have no responsibility other than sending a letter. I mean, if I'm a tire manufacturer and I sell tires and I wind up, you know, producing a tire that's faulty and that's going to cause people to die or be damaged, you know, I have to replace the tire. I have to do a recall. I don't have to just send the guy a letter saying, oh, by the way, don't drive on this tire. Thank you. Have a nice day.
But we are seeing some movements in the liability chain, like as with that case of the of Merrick Bank suing the PCI auditor for card systems who were owned back in 2004 and were storing all of their data in clear text. I mean, don't you see that this could change the industry dynamic and the liability dynamic for in a good way?
Yeah, eventually it's going to sort itself out. I'm very concerned though, because, you know, I mean, I do a fair amount of work in patent litigation, and what I see in these kinds of situations is that it's the system, the people who are part of the system, it's the judges and the lawyers who do very well. But none of these things actually serve the customer. And that's what concerns me, because ultimately information security breaches harm real people. They harm companies too, but the reason they harm companies is because they're inconveniencing and they're harming real people. And I do not think it's appropriate for our lawmakers to basically grant indemnity to companies for screwing up.
Mm-hmm. On that note, would you like to see a PCI DSS auditing company that had screwed up its job and had given someone a tick when they shouldn't have? Would you like to see them found liable by the courts and then successfully sued?
No, I don't think so.
And why is that, Marcus? Go on.
Well, I mean, there's some interesting examples there. You know, if you're selling a chainsaw and the chainsaw is safety equipment and the customer disables the safety equipment and cuts themselves, it's not the chainsaw manufacturer's fault. If a chainsaw manufacturer sells a chainsaw that's hazardous and that doesn't work and that, you know, has a tendency to occasionally break apart and mangle the customer.
Well, hang on, Marcus. Let me just extend that analogy a little bit. Say I've bought that chainsaw, and then I hire a guy who's a chainsaw safety expert to come round to my house and look at my chainsaw. I pay him good money to look at that chainsaw and say, yep, your chainsaw is 100% safe for operation. Then I start it blows up, it takes my arm off.
Yep.
Do you think that
and
person should be liable? Well,
I think they should be liable. If they were, first off, if they were stupid enough to say it's 100% safe. But the problem is that really, for the PCI analogy, what they've really done is they've come in and they've said, well, all of the safety equipment on your chainsaw appears to be present and functioning normally. That's all they've said, right? So there's really, you know, what's going to have to happen is it's going to get sorted out. I mean, if I stick the chainsaw on my foot deliberately, they're going to say, well, you didn't use the thing in a safe manner. It's your fault.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. They somehow managed to get a, you know, CISP tick, despite the fact that they were storing all of their credit card numbers in clear text in a database.
Yeah.
There's got to be some liability issues there, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's definitely some, well, at the very least, there's a question of professional competence. That's a very important question. And, you know, this is the problem with all of these kind of certifications is that there's a tremendous amount of money at stake, whereas a manufacturer of a consumer device that costs $60, like a chainsaw, you know, or $100 or whatever.
I was going to say, where can you get a chainsaw for $60, man? I'm coming to the States.
Mine cost about $250. But
that's because
you
bought the BMW chainsaw, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I got a Louis Vuitton chainsaw, but yeah.
No one buys American anymore.
Mine's Swedish, yeah. But anyway, made in China, but it's got a Swedish logo on it.
Nice.
But anyway, you know, these things all really sort themselves out. And what it boils down to in all of these cases is that liability comes from making a claim that isn't true. And if you're claiming that something is good and it's not, then you're liable. Which brings me back to my first point. If I am a consumer and I give you my data expecting you to keep it secure and you don't, you should bear more liability than just having to send me a letter saying, oops, I screwed up. Mm. Right now, what's going on is that our system is losing, hemorrhaging money like crazy, trying to continue doing practices that have not worked.
Marcus Renham, thank you very much for your time.
Entirely my pleasure.
Marcus Ranham on the line from the USA there in this week's sponsor interview. Now, before we go, I should mention an event that Risky Business is backing. There's an e-crime symposium on in Sydney on the 4th of August with a whole raft of great speakers. If you work in a fraud-prone industry, you'll really want to be at this conference. It's not so much a security conference, it is really an e-crime conference. Head over to ecrimesymposium.com, no dashes or any fancy characters, just ecrimesymposium.com for some more information. Now, I've had several comments from all sorts of listeners in all sorts of places who really like this band, who are called Marshall and the Fro. They're an independent act, and you can buy this album by mail order at marshallmusic.com.au. I actually used to play keyboards with these guys every now and then as a sit-in performer and did some awesome gigs with them, and I'm glad everyone out there really enjoys them. This song by Marshall and the Fro is called The Player, and I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Oh, player, looking at you. I got the high.